Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated October 21st. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On today's front cover, jobless tax to rise to pay debt by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh, the state's decision to delay repaying billions of dollars it borrowed from the federal government to pay unemployment benefits will mean higher taxes for North Carolina's 860,000 employers. The federal unemployment tax, or FUTA, rate that companies in the state pay is expected to increase by 0.3% on their 2011 tax bills due to the IRS on January 31, 2012. For an employer of 50 workers, the rate bump will add about $1,050 to their FUTA bill. Multiply the rate increase by the FUTA obligation of all North Carolina companies, however, and the higher payments mushroom into millions of dollars. North Carolina is one of 27 states being hit with a rate increase because the federal loans they borrowed to pay jobless claims have now been outstanding for more than 2 years. Quickly running through its reserves as recessionary layoffs pushed unemployment into double digits, the Employment Security Commission of North Carolina borrowed more than $2.5 billion from the U.S. Department of Labor to pay benefits. It and other borrowing states have until November 10 to repay their loans or face higher FUTA taxes, says Department of Labor spokesman Tom Crowley. The legislature didn't appropriate the money to pay back the $2.5 billion, hence the rate increase will be imposed. Lynn Holmes, who heads the ESC in North Carolina, mentioned the matter in a recent letter to General Assembly leaders. Quote, since the General Assembly took no substantive action in this past session to address the repayment of the debt, we expect North Carolina employers to see their effective FUTA tax rate increased, she wrote. Already employers in three states, South Carolina, Michigan, and Indiana, have been saddled with higher FUTA taxes over the repayment issue. That was for the 2010 tax year. Besides North Carolina, other states affected by the potential 2011 rate hikes include California, Georgia, Virginia, New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. Department of Labor, which uses the FUTA collections to defray administrative costs and make state loans, is expected to make a formal announcement of the states affected after the November 10 deadline. Following that, it will be up to the IRS to notify individual employers that their rate has been changed, says ESC spokesman Larry Parker. Here's how the FUTA system works. North Carolina companies pay two unemployment taxes. The first is paid to the state quarterly and is based on a company's employment record. The collected proceeds are used by ESC to pay jobless benefits. The federal FUTA portion goes to the IRS annually. Employers pay FUTA on the first $7,000 of a worker's yearly pay at a flat rate of 6.2%. That changed to 6% in July. Companies with a record of timely state payments are allowed to take a credit on their federal tax, writing down the 6.2% federal rate by 5.4%. That has brought their effective rate to 0.8%. It was the 0.8% for the first half of 2011, 0.6% for the second half. And for North Carolina and the other states that haven't repaid their loans, however, the federal credit is being cut from 5.4% to 5.1%. That action, in effect, adds the 0.3% back onto an employer's effective rate, which now becomes 1.1%. If North Carolina can't come up with a way of repaying the $2.5 billion in 2012, the state could face another 0.3% FUTA jump next year as well. Commerce Secretary Keith Crisco recently sent General Assembly leaders a list of repayment options, including increasing the rate the state charges employers in its portion of the two-pronged unemployment tax. Another option under discussion would have the state sell bonds to raise revenue to make the repayment. Also on the front page, federal judges in North Carolina are the strictest. by Chris Bagley. From Raleigh, federal judicial districts of Central and Eastern North Carolina have become the toughest in the nation for criminal defendants, with the longest prison sentences in the federal system and rates of prosecution that are climbing higher, according to statistics compiled by Syracuse University researchers. Law enforcement officials suggest a range of reasons for the lengthening sentences here, including an increased focus on drug crimes, which tend to carry long sentences, at a time prosecutors in many other districts are focusing on immigration-related crimes that result in little or no prison time. The median sentence in the Eastern District of North Carolina, which stretches from Wake County to the coast, increased from 54 months in the 2005 federal fiscal year to 71 months last year, longer than any other of the 93 districts in the federal court system, according to Syracuse University Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, which draws data from the U.S. attorneys and other federal agencies. The Middle District of North Carolina, stretching from Durham County through Greensboro and Winston-Salem, had a median sentence of 68 months, the nation's second highest figure. By comparison, federal convicts receive a median of 60 months in the district that includes Charlotte, 46 months in South Carolina District, and 33 months in the district that includes Atlanta, according to the TRAC. Sentences in the Middle and Eastern districts have been relatively long for years, according to the track, and George Holding, who was U.S. Attorney in the Eastern District from 2006 until his retirement last year. He was the office's number two prosecutor for 4 years prior to taking the top job. The median sentence in Holding's district grew steadily to 77 months in the 2009 year, when it was also number one. The median sentence has increased similarly, but less dramatically, in the Middle District. Holding credits Chief Narcotics Prosecutor Frank Bradshaw and Chief Violent Crimes Prosecutor Jane Jackson, who served under him and continue to serve under his successor, Thomas Walker. The office began to prosecute more violent crimes in the early 2000s, Holding says, and the track database shows a steep and steady increase in drug prosecutions to 388 last year from 221 in 2005, and an increase in convictions as well. Prosecutions and convictions increased in most other categories, but less steeply. Lieutenant Craig Haynes, who oversees the Raleigh Police Department's drug unit, says cooperation with Jackson's prosecutors has grown extensively over the years. Federal prosecutors receive cases from a range of investigating agencies, including police departments, sheriffs, the FBI, and the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration. Federal prosecutors' heightened focus on drugs and violence accounts for much of the increase in length of sentences, because both carry relatively long sentences regardless of who's prosecuting and who's judging. But the 10-year sentence received by a typical narcotics convict in the Eastern District and Middle District compares to the median 4-year sentence for convicts in the nation as a whole. Holding and other law enforcement officials suggest several additional reasons for the increase, including a growing prevalence of repeat offenders who receive longer sentences under federal formulas. Officials say it's also possible that individual judges are sentencing towards the maximum end of the ranges within their discretion. Perhaps the North Carolina district's widest divergence from national trends stems from a steep increase in immigration prosecutions in many federal districts, particularly those along the nation's southern border. Federal prosecutors filed 87,400 immigration cases nationwide last year, an increase of nearly 50,000 since 2006. Prosecutions in most other categories have declined slightly. Convictions on federal immigration charges typically carry sentences of a couple of months or no prison time at all. Median prison sentences last year in Arizona, New Mexico, and southern Texas were just 1 month last year. And now, insurer lures companies with multiple health plans, by Jason DeBrune from Raleigh. United Healthcare is making waves in the group health insurance market and causing some other providers to take note. In July, United increased the options it offers to small business employers, or more specifically, it allowed small business employers to offer more options to their employees, and with very little change to the employer health insurance cost. Since August 1st, United has signed up about 500 new groups, of which 75% are new to United, says Garland Scott, CEO of United Healthcare of the Carolinas. At an average of 25 people per group, that comes out to roughly 12,500 people. The new product is called MultiChoice. Traditionally, small businesses, those with up to 50 employees, have been able to choose only one plan from an insurance company to provide its employees, whether the employee is a young, healthy male, a mother with two children, or an elderly person with frequent doctor visits. With MultiChoice, the employer can offer up to 31 plans to employees, some with a high deductible, some with a low copay, or a range like health savings accounts. Most employers are expected to choose among 3 to 5 of those 31 plans to offer to employees, Scott says. Such a range of options typically have been available to large employers, but for a small business owner, that has not been the case. Typically, the plans come at varying price points, but the employer still pays United a flat rate, and the employee may choose the plan according to affordability or coverage options. This gives employers a way to offer a competitive benefits package to their employees, no matter the size of the company, Scott says. To be sure, providing more choice is not a panacea, and United, at less than 3% market share in the state, has a long way to go to catch Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, which boast 84% market share in the state, according to the North Carolina Department of Insurance. Still, the new product has gotten off to a positive start, and insurance brokers think other insurance providers will have to think hard about offering the same. This is being well received, says Joe Gupton with EBEN Concepts, formerly Jones Insurance. Insurance rates for insurance groups smaller than 100 have gone up drastically in the past 4 years, he says, so giving employers a way to provide employees with options is good. That's actually a really attractive recruiting tool for employers as well, he says. Tom Snell, with Benefit Services and Design Incorporated, says one of his clients was going to have to stop providing health insurance to his employees, but moved to United because of the MultiChoice. Going forward, he says other insurance providers will have to consider a similar plan to not lose market share. It absolutely makes United more competitive, he says. The competition will have to step up. A Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina spokesman did not comment on the new plan, saying only that the company is looking at its options. Representatives from America's Health Insurance Plan, a national insurance association, declined comment. In 2010, United collected $59 million in premiums in North Carolina. By comparison, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina collected more than $2 billion. United Healthcare of the Carolinas is a subsidiary of United Healthcare based in Minnesota. Nationally, United is on pace to collect more than $90 billion in premiums in 2011. Today's lead article on the front page is Hurry Up and Wait. RD Connections to Boston and JFK Lead the Late List by Chris Bagley. From Morrisville. If you're taking JetBlue's 6:30 p.m. flight to Boston, bring a book, or maybe two. Flights to and from Boston's Logan International Airport are among the most frequently delayed at RDU International, according to analysis of federal data from December 2010 through August. What's more, Logan tops the list of airports with severe, chronic delays of flights coming to and from RDU, according to the analysis, based on monthly data from the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. Delays are also frequent for JetBlue and a handful of regional airlines, the data show, and late afternoon flights offered by a range of airlines frequently end up delayed, according to the data. About 28% of flights from RDU to Logan between June 1 and August 31st arrive more than 15 minutes late, compared to just 21% of the flights to Chicago O'Hare and 17% of the flights to Atlanta. Of 22 regular flights that were delayed repeatedly for more than 30 minutes in the nine-month period, 7 were either to or from Logan. Another delayed flight to Boston, Ron Nelson, CEO of Raleigh-based online marketing firm Kazoo.com, tweeted in apparent resignation as he waited to board October 13 suite. Also in the Bring a Book category are flights to New York's JFK International Airport. Two of the 22 delayed flights were either to or from JFK, which handles considerably more overall traffic to and from Raleigh-Durham than does Logan. The federal agency counted 29% of the flights between RDU and JFK as late by the 15-minute standard. Grouped by airline instead of airport, the statistics consistently show JetBlue as the most delayed airline, both nationally and at Raleigh-Durham. Airline analyst and consultant Robert Mann says that has a lot to do with the airports that JetBlue serves, many of which are in large cities such as Boston and New York. The Big Apple's three airports, JFK, LaGuardia International, and Newark International, across the Hudson River in New Jersey, frequently cause delays at one another because of their sheer size and proximity and the resulting crowding of airspace, Mann says. And those three may also interfere with flights between Boston and North Carolina, Mann says. Airlines that aren't equipped with life rafts and other safety equipment can't detour over the Atlantic Ocean to avoid traffic. Furthermore, Logan is handicapped by a shortage of instrumentation to handle some of the airplane's approaches. That limits the use of some runways during times of limited visibility. Even so, JetBlue flights to Boston and New York were delayed about 50% more often than other carriers' flights to those airports, according to the transportation agency's data. Southwest is the only other major airline with chronically delayed flights to RDU, with one series of delays on a 1:55 p.m. flight from Baltimore in December, and another series of delays on a 7:10 p.m. flight from Nashville in January. Most of the other chronic delays were flights operated by regional carriers, American Eagle Airlines, Atlantic Southeast Airlines, ExpressJet, and Pinnacle Airlines. Mann says regional airlines often get forced aside through no fault of their own. It usually happens during crowded periods with limited numbers of takeoff slots. Air traffic controllers assign a given number of slots to a major airline and its regional partners, and the majors usually allow their own planes to board and take off first under the rationale that they're carrying more passengers. Evening flights are also fraught with delays. 16 of the 22 chronically delayed flights were scheduled to depart between 4 p.m. and 8 p.m. That's because a delayed flight often causes one or more subsequent flights to be delayed. Those delays tend to pile up in late afternoon and evening flights, says Mindy Ham, RDU spokeswoman. It's a ripple effect, she says. The federal agency's latest monthly report shows airlines' on-time performance weakening in August, a period that coincided with Hurricane Irene. Other monthly reports show no consistent change from last year. Layoffs at American Airlines, whose financial position is weaker than some carriers, have made American less consistent in getting passengers to their destinations, says Glenn Jeans, president of Transport Workers Union Local 569, which represents American's baggage handlers at RDU Airport. Where four or five handlers previously moved 3,000 to 4,000 pounds of baggage from the average airplane and then refilled the plane with a comparable amount of baggage, only three were working most planes this summer, he says. Baggage-related delays eased as planes became less crowded in September, Jean says. It's a 6,000 to 8,000-pound exchange, and you need manpower to do that, Jean says. I think American is doing whatever they can to save money, even if it means poor customer service. Now to the inside of the paper, Durham's Lakeshore Golf Course for Sale, by Jason DeBrun. From Durham, the overbuilt golf course sector could lose another member as an old family-owned triangle course is being marketed for sale as a potential site for residential development. Lakeshore Golf Course, a public course off Lumley Road between Durham and Raleigh, is listed at $14.4 million. The property covers 135 acres of land and includes a 45-acre lake and floodplain. Marvin Utley III owns the course, which was incorporated in 1975 and has remained in the family. The land is being advertised as a potential site for low- or medium-density multifamily residential But any change in zoning would need to go through the Durham Planning and Zoning Office first. Merle White, a real estate agent with Commercial USA who represents the property, says a residential development would be the highest and best use right now for the property. Utley, who could not be reached directly, declined to comment through White. The property is in a desirable location just north of Briar Creek. Durham Planning Director Stephen Medlin says his office would consider recommending a zoning change, but would need to see an application before issuing a final ruling. I think it sounds reasonable, but there have been no determination yet, he says. Other factors such as environmental transportation and floodplain regulations would come into consideration before issuing a zoning change. The planning department only provides recommendation for a zoning change. A decision rests in the hands of the Durham County Commissioners. Putting Lakeshore on the market comes on the heels of Old Liberty, a course in Franklin County, also being put up for sale. Nationwide trends are showing the same after developers built a record-setting number of courses in the past decade, says Mike Hughes, CEO of the National Golf Course Owners Association. The consequences was an overbuild, he said. Since that time, it has been seeking equilibrium. Hughes could not predict exactly where that equilibrium is, especially in a suppressed economy, he says, but it's finding its way there. White has marketed the Lakeshore property to about 50 developers, including to those who build continuing care or retirement communities, but says he has not gotten a lot of bites yet. As you know, this is a pretty tough economy, he says. If a buyer would like to keep the property as a golf course, White says that would not be a problem. With golf rates ranging from $20 to $42, Lakeshore is one of the more affordable courses in the area. As for private clubs, Jack Nance, the executive director of the Carolinas Golf Association, says clubs and memberships have slowly declined in the past 10 years. At the peak in 2000, there were 729 clubs in North Carolina and South Carolina, with 192,000 members total. Those numbers have declined by about 15% in both the number of clubs and members. I think the market was probably overbuilt, especially in the Myrtle Beach area, Nance says. The economy hasn't helped, but Nance says the decline of membership was steady long before the market crash of 2008. What concerns Nance most is that the club members won't come back, deciding instead to play public or semi-private courses more regularly. Golf is certainly a discretionary spending sport, he says. Golf memberships are one of the first things to go. I still think it's a fantastic game, but I'm trying to be as realistic as I can. Next up, job cutting by governments a drag on North Carolina, by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The shedding of government jobs, especially at the federal and state levels, has been one of the significant drags on North Carolina's economy since January. The private sector in the state, still recovering from the Great Recession, was able to add 21,400 jobs in the 8 months between January and August. Meanwhile, three layers of government in the state chopped 12,300, leaving the economy with a net gain of only 9,100 for the eight-month period. It's been a decline that is really weighing against the recovery, labor market expert John Quintero of Chapel Hill-based South by North Strategy says of the government job cuts. The seasonally adjusted numbers were compiled by the Employment Security Commission of North Carolina. In Quintero's views, government employment has been hit by two factors: the winding down of federal stimulus spending that began in early 2011, and tighter government budgets in the face of declining federal help and sluggish or falling tax revenue. Data on what effects those summertime budget actions have had on government payrolls is only just beginning to arrive. Using the numbers that are available, it is possible to see where most of those government cuts have been made through August. In the 12 months ending August 31st, North Carolina's total payroll for government jobs at all levels fell by 2.1% to 685,300. Breaking that down, the number of federal jobs declined by 2,330, a 4% drop, to 68,970. At the state level, 16,300 workers lost jobs, a decline of 8%, to 182,000. breaking the pattern, but not by much, were local governments, county and municipal. They actually added jobs during the 12 months, growing their collective payroll by nearly 1.1%, 4,600 workers to 434,400. Whether the positive trend in local hiring will continue after the budget decisions made by city and county officials during the summer take effect isn't clear at this point. The North Carolina Association of County Commissioners is still compiling its survey of budget actions taken by the state's 100 counties. A few made cuts. Some eliminated vacant positions, says the association's Todd McGee, who adds, however, that large-scale cuts didn't appear to have happened as 2012 spending plans were crafted. A similar survey by the North Carolina League of Municipalities is also in the works, but not yet available, says Matt Lael, the organization's spokesman. Nationwide, according to the National League of Cities, local governments have chopped 535,000 positions since September 2008 and may eliminate another 265,000 by the end of 2012. Still inside the cover, scanning for sponges. Hospitals Technology looks for items inside patients after surgery. By Jason DeBrun from Chapel Hill. UNC hospitals will use radio frequencies in an effort to keep medical sponges from being left in patients after surgery. The hospital system affiliated with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill contracted with Bellevue, Washington-based RF Surgical Systems Incorporated to upfit all 39 operating rooms with radio frequency mats and wands to better detect if sponges used during surgery were left behind in a patient. The technology will cut down on surgery time and increase safety, says Stella Nelson, project manager for the Surgical Services Division at UNC Hospitals. But most importantly, it will help ensure no devices are sewn inside a patient after surgery. The technology is fairly simple. A small sensor is embedded in each medical sponge, which is made of a thick gauze to soak up blood and body fluids during surgery. As a sponge becomes saturated, nurses and surgeons find it difficult to locate in the body. When they get wet, they can be very, very small, Nelson says. They take on the look of their surroundings, and it's hard to find them. That's where the radio frequency devices come in. A nurse can wave the wand over the patient, similar to a treasure hunter waving a metal detector over the sand, to determine where the sponge is located. Under the terms of the contract, RF Surgical Systems installed the equipment for free, and UNC hospitals will buy special sponges from the company. RF-tagged disposable surgical lap sponge, gauze, and operating room towel cost $12 to $15 per surgery on average, says RF Surgical CFO David Gusling. The total added cost will amount to $350,000 per year, Nelson says. Traditionally, nurses have started with a count method by simply counting the sponges before and after surgery. If one is missing, the nurses must try to locate it, possibly in the trash or on the floor, but also possibly hiding in a patient. If a nurse thinks the sponge was left in a patient, an X-ray is called, sometimes prolonging the anesthesia time by 30 minutes, subjecting the patient to radiation and keeping the body open for that much longer. Nurses will still use the traditional count method as a first check, but the radio frequency equipment will cut down on added time and eliminate the X-ray. In fact, the time saved in initial surgery and any time and damage saved from leaving a sponge inside a patient could amount to a savings of more than $350,000, Nelson says. This adjunctive technology has helped us bring the highest quality of care to our patients by preventing unnecessary X-rays and repeat surgeries and potentially lowering anesthesia time, says Dr. Christopher Clarence Rupp, a surgeon at UNC Hospital. To be sure, losing medical equipment in a patient is rare, as few as 1 in 15,000 surgeries, estimates Nelson. Still, even one is too many, she says, and the new equipment offers the other benefits of finding lost equipment as well. The North Carolina Hospital Association has partnered with the World Health Organization to encourage all hospitals to adopt a surgery checklist to increase safety. This new barcode technology sounds helpful to protect patient safety and should be used in conjunction with the hospital checklist, says Stephanie Strickland with the NCHA. Next up, Blaine reveals CQ's secret for sake of accountability. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. State Employees Credit Union CEO Jim Blaine's answer to the discontent that produced the Occupy Wall Street movement was to make public his organization's usually secret regulatory rating. Despite such transparency being displayed by the $23 billion total asset CQ, the nation's second largest credit union, don't expect to see Blaine's move to catch on in financial services industry as a whole. That's because, for banks insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and for federally chartered credit unions, laws are on the books blocking release of a lender's CAMEL score. The regulators, in effect, own the rating scores they pass out to those institutions. CAMEL is the 1-5 rating scale that measures a company's capital adequacy, asset quality, management expertise, earnings, and liquidity. CQ, State Employees Credit Union, however, is a state-chartered credit union, and North Carolina doesn't have a law blocking release. That was a hole Blaine and his lieutenants squeezed through when they recently released CQ's CAMEL rating of 2. Under the system, 1 is the strongest score possible, while 5 represents weakness verging on collapse. This is an experiment, Blaine says. The old-time thinking was that releasing a score might cause a run. But with the financial services industry now faced with mounting distress, Blaine adds, that old notion has turned on its head. There is a need to disclose for the sake of accountability. He simply thinks he owed it to CQ's 1.7 million members to tell them how their credit union is doing. CQ's release sent people who follow the credit union industry searching through their memories and notes for a precedent. This just doesn't happen, says David Small, spokesman for the National Credit Union Administration, which follows the policy of strict non-release. Moreover, the regulatory agency says that its CAMEL rating are not necessarily identical to those issued by state regulators. The score Blaine released was the one given CQ by the North Carolina Credit Union Division, a part of the North Carolina Department of Commerce, an overseer of 50 state-chartered credit unions. Division head Jerry Jay says North Carolina's confidentiality law gives her the discretion to release a CAMEL, and since CQ is one of only 3 U.S. credit unions with enough asset heft, at least $10 billion, to come under the new Dodd-Frank Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, she decided to give permission. It's a matter of transparency, she says, and for an institution that size, transparency is good. The CAMEL score CQ released to the public was a rating of the credit union status as of September 30, 2010. Blaine says examiners currently are crunching CQ's numbers and will come up with a new CAMEL score for 2011. He plans to seek permission to release that score as well before the year is out. As part of the experiment, he says, after that, we'll see. Continuing on, transportation sector wary of global FASB guidelines, by Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Proposed changes in accounting rules could force transportation companies to pay more in interest on their borrowings. The changes, affecting a company's leased aircraft, trucks, and limousines, would eliminate the use of operating leases, an accounting method under which a company must record the future cost of such leases as a liability on their balance sheet. Accountants say the resulting changes in financial ratios could make such companies appear financially shakier, leading some lenders to demand higher interest rates as compensation for what they would view as a greater risk. Some borrowers now viewed as a marginal, might not be able to borrow at all under the new rules, accountants say. The changes are particularly daunting for transportation companies, many of which lease equipment because leases can allow them to respond more readily to changing routes and customers' changing needs. U.S. Airways Group, the number three carrier at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, in terms of number of passengers, uses operating lease accounting for roughly two-thirds of its airplanes. As of December 31, 2010, the company expected to pay $6.4 billion over the life of those leases. Under the proposed rules, those payments would appear on U.S. Air's balance sheet as a liability of perhaps $4.5 billion to $5.5 billion. The company's actual balance sheet reported $6.7 billion in liabilities and $7.5 billion in assets as of December 31st. Local number one carrier Southwest Airlines Company and Phoenix, Arizona-based Swift Transportation Company, which ships throughout the Southeast, uses operating leases to account for about 15% of their fleets. Their balance sheets might expand in the ranges of $1.5 billion and $80 million, respectively. Many accountants expect the balance sheet overhauls to happen in 2014 or 2015. Brad Newkirk, an accounting partner in Dixon Hughes Goodman LLP's High Point office, says that's likely still to be a difficult time for the transportation sector and potentially throw up new hurdles to borrowing. Most publicly traded companies and most privately held companies seeking loans and investments are required to produce financial statements according to a common set of standards known as Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, or GAAP. GAAP now allows some long-term leases to stay off corporate balance sheets. Such operating leases involve only the periodic recording of the lease payments and other expenses. Accountants say the charges, which are under consideration by the Financial Accounting Standards Board, the private sector group that controls GAAP, would probably raise the company's debt-to-equity ratio, cause some expenses to be reclassified as high-interest expense, and erode return on asset figures. Those changed ratios will probably make lenders hesitant to lend to some who are already considered moderately risky and could prompt lenders to demand higher interest rates from others, Newkirk says. Trucking companies have had a very tough time during this recession, Newkirk says. Some of their relationships with banks are tenuous. Trucking companies I have as clients have had reductions in force, and a lot of that has been among the accountants. At best, companies may have to pay a bit more for accounting services, accountants say, and most companies with transformed balance sheets will at least have a shot at explaining the changes to lenders and investors, they say. But that may be a challenge with smaller and less sophisticated banks, and with banks with rigid lending guidelines, he says. But others may face higher credit rates and tighter credit, he says. Moreover, covenants in some existing loan agreements require borrowers to keep within certain debt ratios, accountants say. New liabilities on their balance sheets would require some companies to pay higher interest rates and put others in technical default. Transportation companies should take the coming changes into account when negotiating covenants on new borrowings, says John Hepp, a senior accountant with Grant Thornton, the nation's fifth-largest accounting firm, who has advised the American Trucking Association on the proposed rule changes. Hepp says he expects the changes to apply to leases of longer than 1 year. Next up, for Semprobacker's IPO may mean financing, not liquidity. By Sukada Murheji, from Chapel Hill. On a beautiful spring morning, early this year, Sempra Pharmaceutical CEO Prabha Fernandez passionately was preaching the need for new drugs in front of 100-odd attendees at a healthcare symposium. Fernandez was animated. She pointed out that drug development isn't easy and is far from an exact science. She talked about the might of Sempra's fundraising abilities, tying that heft to the research conducted inside Sempra's offices that hold some 20 workers, a majority of them with a doctorate degree. If all goes well, Fernandez will be taking her preach-and-tell show to a slew of institutional investors soon as the company embarks on selling $86 million worth of stock to the public. Showing support to Fernandez would be her current investors in Durham-based InterSouth Partners and New York-based Isling Partners and Pennsylvania-based Wistar Morris and Quaker's BioVentures. They've helped Sempra raise $78 million in three rounds of venture capital and assisted the company in recruiting some high-octane medical talent. Founded in 2006, Sempra's lead products target drug-resistant bacterial infections. Unusual for most small drug development companies, Sempra is trying to see through the clinical stages not one but two drugs. One of them is an oral antibiotic that is being developed as a treatment for severe skin infections, and the other is a drug that attacks infections in the respiratory tract of the patient. As reports from Renaissance Capital show, Sempra executives likely will have an uphill battle as they try to convince some of the primary players in life science IPOs, such as Deerfield Ventures, T. Rowe Price, and Fidelity, to join the company's existing investors in seeing through the Phase 3 clinical trials of the drug. IPO market conditions are frequently fragile due to volatility in the broader markets and weak economic indicators, says Stephanie Chang, a research analyst with Connecticut-based Renaissance Capital. Life sciences in particular may be suffering due to increased risk aversion on behalf of IPO investors. These investors are looking for companies with exciting growth prospects, solid management team, and reasonable valuations. So far in 2011, there have been 12 health care IPOs compared to 17 last year. Of the 12 IPOs, half were drug companies, two were hospital operators, two were products and instruments, and the remaining two were diagnostic companies. Performance has been mixed, underlying the fact that investors remain highly selective, says Chang. Thanks to Fernanda's passion with her laser-focused determination to follow the completion of the clinical trials, the company's existing investors, mainly venture capital firms, may end up buying a big portion of Sempra's additional shares. Historically, venture capital firms invested in drug development companies saw the completion of Phase 2B trials as the end game to liquidate their holdings and cash in their investments. Not anymore. The sands are somewhat shifting in this life science sector, says Art Pappas, principal of A&M Pappas & Associates of Durham, one of the region's largest life science-specific venture capital firms. Because a pre-Phase 3 valuation of companies has dropped significantly, venture capital firms are now funding the expensive Phase 3 trials of the two drugs scheduled to start the Phase 3 trials next year. Essentially, we're now seeing the IPO markets being used as a financing event rather than a liquidity event for venture capital firms, Pappas says. The same may be true for Sempra. As part of the successful IPO, the company's strong VC lineup may have to dole out a sizable portion of the targeted $86 million. Gary Shamus, managing principal for Cleveland, Ohio-based SS&G, an accounting firm that has helped companies with their regulatory obligations, says other than private equity, the IPO market is the only avenue to raise capital for drug development and technology companies. Private equity firms are generally not interested in a company at this early a stage, Shamus says. Sempra's window to raise the required money is fast closing. Data filed with regulators show the company used up about $8 million in the first 6 months of this year on research and development. As of June 30, Sempra had about $10 million left in its coffers. Security rules prohibit company executives from discussing a public stock offering. Duke Scaling Back Ambitious Goals for Research Campus by Jennifer Thomas from Kannapolis. Duke University is unlikely to build a facility on the NC Research Campus as originally planned, at least not anytime soon, and its enrolling of local residents in an ambitious biomedical study at the Kannapolis site is on pace to take 10 years, twice as long as Duke has estimated. A university official stresses that Duke remains committed to the MURDOCK study for measures to understand the reclassification of disease of Cabarrus and Kannapolis, also known as MURDOCK. and study organizers continue to enroll roughly 200 to 300 participants in the research program each month. The Murdoch study is certainly a landmark study and very important to Duke, says Ashley Dunham, project leader for the study. But there would have to be a lot more Duke activities on the research campus to justify an investment like that, she adds, concerning a university building on the campus. Duke is directing the Biomedical Research Project, which is named for campus founder David Murdoch. Murdoch, a California billionaire and Dole Food Company chairman, made a $35 million donation to support the study. It fits the 350-acre life sciences hub focus on health, nutrition, and agriculture. Plans had called for Duke to fund its own facility on the campus before the economy soured. The Durham-based university has an office in Kannapolis with about 20 full-time employees. Campus developer Castle & Cook, North Carolina, did not respond to this week for a request for comment. Dunham says the Murdoch study remains focused on creating a large community registry, including medical histories of local participants and a biorepository of blood and other samples. The registry seeks to include a diverse mix of ages and medical backgrounds. To date, about 7,000 people have enrolled in the study with an ultimate goal of 50,000 participants. The latter represents about 28% of the county's population. We still have a plan, budget, and strategies for 50,000, Dunham says. She adds that slower enrollment will preserve funding and increase the focus on research. The study seeks to improve healthcare by changing the way doctors treat diseases based on the traits of individual patients. For every 1,000 patients we enroll, it gets more and more interesting and more valuable to the research community and just does a better job of representing the people of Cabarrus County and Kannapolis, Dunham says. In the next decade, she wants the Murdoch study to garner national attention. She anticipates multiple groups, including industry and academic collaborators, and will access the study's database and samples for research study. That outside collaboration brings additional access to grant and research funding, Dunham says. The data collected so far is already being used. That includes studies related to multiple sclerosis and to examine the genetic makeup of a group of centenarians. Screening during enrollment may allow participants to take part in a Phase 3 clinical trial related to Alzheimer's. If we stopped enrolling today, which we're not planning on doing, but if we stopped today or only got 10,000 people, it would still be an extremely powerful study, Dunham says. Slower enrollment makes it possible to pursue other opportunities to promote the study and raise awareness of its goals. For example, Duke officials are making presentations at other universities to promote collaborative research arrangements, and they want to publish scientific papers related to the study. Study organizers also are establishing the parameters for what is known as a representative sample for Cabarrus County and Kannapolis. That controlled participant sample would allow the Murdoch study to target individuals who live in a specific geographic area. It would have a defined start and end date for recruitment. Durham estimates that about 15,000 will be enrolled in that sample. We can infer that anything we discover in this population would be applicable to the entire population of Cabarrus and Kannapolis, Dunham says. And now it's time for A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Step Up expands help for jobless. Step Up Ministry in Raleigh expects this year to serve about 700 unemployed, low-income, and homeless individuals and families, including 125 veterans, up from a total of 600 clients in 2010. Making that increase possible will be a new job center, the Interfaith nonprofit opened October 10th at its offices at 1701 Oberlin Road in space donated by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. But that expansion represents only part of the agency's plan to help provide more people with the tools they need to become employed and move towards a stable life for themselves and their families, says Linda Nunnally, the group's development director. Step Up also is developing plans to brand or franchise its three-step process that provides clients and their families with job training and placement, vocational training, and life skills development. And starting a year from now, it hopes to double the number of clients it serves. Steve Swain, executive director at Step Up, says the group already has the infrastructure in place to expand, including technology and experienced staff. Launched in 1988, Step Up operates with a staff of 24 people, five of whom are graduates of its program, and an annual budget of $1.4 million, which it expects to grow to $1.7 million in 2012. When they first go to Step Up, clients spend a week in a workshop that provides job readiness training. Step Up counselors then work with clients to find jobs, with separate Step Up employment recruiters networking with companies that may have job openings. And once clients are employed, those who are ready begin a year-long life skills curriculum with their children. This year, Step Up expects to place more than 300 people in jobs, up from 225 in 2010, and provide life skills development to 100 adults and 150 children. Step Up uses web-based software developed by Salesforce.com to manage its relationships with clients and employers, and it equips its staff with iPads to make communications and data collection easy and seamless. The new job center, housed in the 1,500-square-foot renovated basement in Step Up's building, brings its total space to 4,000 square feet. To double the number of clients it serves, Step Up will need to raise an additional $300,000 a year, a total it expects to generate initially with proceeds from a gala in December celebrating the 25th anniversary of the John William Pope Foundation. Step Up receives roughly 70% of its budget through private support from churches, individuals, corporations, and foundations such as the Pope Foundation and A.J. Fletcher Foundation, and 30% from city, county, and federal governments. Prompted by more than a year of exchanging information with First Presbyterian Church of Greensboro, which is developing a program based on Step Up's three-step process, a Step Up committee this month will recommend to its board whether to franchise that process or make it available to groups in other communities. In preparation, we've spent the last year looking very closely at the programs and process we offer, Nunnally says, to make sure we're doing it as well as we can. Now from the opinion page and the editor's notebook. Brian Kaberline, titled Balance Between Social Issues and Profits. A local branch of the Occupy Wall Street movement marched down Main Street with signs and a bullhorn-led chant that says, "We are the 99%. I felt kind of sorry for the dozen and a half marchers, whose measly numbers nevertheless were enough to compromise a noticeable throng in downtown Kansas City during normal working hours. The easy question is, if you're the 99%, why aren't there more of you? And one viable answer to that, in this country, many are loath to criticize the ultra-rich because they idolize them and are convinced that they will join the ranks of the super-rich when the breaks go their way. The phenomenon crosses racial, age, and income divides. You find it in the kid who studies his crossover drivel instead of math because he's sure he is the next LeBron James, and the blue-collar worker dreaming of what she'll do when she's the boss, and the middle-class office worker who can only fill the gas tank halfway yet buys a couple of Powerball tickets, and in the small business owners who parrot support for the very breaks that larger competitors use against them. The belief in the big jackpot, in the land of milk and honey, in the, you get my point, is as old as humanity. It has guided Columbus and the Donner Party, Andrew Carnegie, and human traffickers. The best way to preserve the positive attributes of the aspiration for wealth and reduce the negative attributes is to reward extraordinary deeds and talents and to keep the game fair enough that people can hope to improve their lots, absent rich parents or a lucky Powerball ticket. Eliminating all taxes and regulations is not the golden ticket to prosperity and happiness. Show me a place with nominal government services and few regulations, and I'll show you a place where the population's main goal is to leave. The United States doesn't just need jobs, it needs non-commodity jobs that allow those willing to work hard to do better than survive. If we're willing to settle for low-skill, low-wage service jobs, we'll watch our economy flatline and our brightest kids either give up or move. And human capital also can flow globally. A strong economy and a high standard of living require a balance of freedom and rules. A free flow of capital aids innovation and growth, but markets won't thrive for long where corruption and fraud go unchecked. This point is important for the Occupy Wall Street forces, too. Regulators should examine the actions of large investment banks and traders, but fining and regulating the financial sector into oblivion will hurt all of us. Balancing freedom and limits, profits and social contract is the key to a thriving, prosperous United States. This balance gives a young Bill Gates or Steve Jobs a chance to turn ideas and ambition into world-changing products and, yes, wealth. Brian Kaberline is the editor of the Kansas City Business Journal, a Triangle Business Journal sister newspaper. Triangle Business Journal Biz thought Cub Scout Pinewood Derby competitions had gone the way of the rotary phone. After all, what kid today wants to chunk a bunch of plywood together to fashion a wooden car that rolls down a steep hill? Folks at the Okanichee Council of the Boy Scouts of America evidently believe there's still interest. The council has scheduled an inaugural corporate Pinewood Derby on Saturday, November 12, at the State Fairgrounds. In this derby, businesses and other organizations will field teams competing the three categories: by the book, anything goes, and best of show. A $500 entry fee gets a team 3-car kits so they can enter all three categories. In addition, the teams will receive 4 pit passes good for admission to the competition and to the Carolina Collectors Auto Fest at the fairgrounds. 2 passes to a dinner buffet reception at the RBC Center preceding the Carolina Hurricanes game that night, and 2 tickets to watch the Hurricanes take on the Pittsburgh Penguins. We've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.triangleradioreadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.